So it is Thanksgiving weekend, right? In Canada, because of course Thanksgiving is different in different places. And as it happens in Canada, this Thanksgiving weekend falls close on the heels of our first, you know, government-sanctioned National Day of Truth and Reconciliation. And you know that whole when you see something you can't unsee it idea? That one's been dogging my steps a little bit regarding the intersection between attending to truth and reconciliation and the event we call Thanksgiving for a while now. And this past week, it sort of came to a head. And so that's what I ended up exploring. It's interesting to me how, as with so many things in my life, I look back on my childhood memories and I realize that to the degree that they were blissful, they were also relatively ignorant. And there's something kind of lovely about that. Like, I really think there is. I mean, as a parent, I've often found myself wanting to shield my kids from the harsher truths about the world. You know, that all in good time feels like a phrase that applies there. They're going to encounter the difficult and the complex realities soon enough. But for now, you know, especially when they were little, our kids are all adults now, but when they were little, it was like, I can buffer that for now. And so I will. And I think that's both a good and a complicated inclination. I mean, of course, we want to keep our kids from staring straight into the most distressing things about history and reality. I don't think it would be responsible or even loving to do otherwise. But that's a space that it can also be hard to know how to leave. And I'm not here today to give parenting advice. I mean, every kid is their own person, and the right time or right way to unlayer these kinds of truths, I don't think that's the sort of thing that falls to a formula. That said, I do know that there are general kind of age-appropriate ways to introduce values and themes and all of that so that our kids aren't knocked off their pins later in life when they find out that the world is complicated and sometimes rather dark. The next part, as complicated as that might be, the next part is, I think, even more complex. I suspect that as adults, sometimes our motivation for not facing head-on into the difficult things with our kids stems from a place in us that is similar to the one that keeps us from facing difficult truths for ourselves. We just don't want to go there. And perhaps it's because we suspect, or maybe we even know by experience, that we can't unsee something once we're aware of it. And honestly, it can just be so much more pleasant to not see the difficult things. You know, there's actually a problematic word in that sentence. I'm thinking of the word honestly, because not facing the truth about life is not, in the end, being honest about it. If choosing self-deception, it's choosing self-deception or willful ignorance over honesty, choosing those things over truth. And the truth is often much more complicated than our self-selected preferences and fantasies. And as we talked about last week, the truth is also liable to, you know, incarcerate us before it sets us free. And that's not necessarily a process that we're all just like, yes, give me some more of that, right? Which brings me back to my childhood memories, and in particular, those about the event of Thanksgiving. In my memory, which is not entirely reliable, but in my memory, Thanksgiving, it was primarily about three things. In no particular order, but also in the order they came most readily to mind. Thanksgiving was about food and family and Thanksgiving. And in our household, the Thanksgiving part of the event would have been mostly represented by kind of a pre-feast prayer, in which God was given credit for all the good things in front of us and surrounding our lives. And then I could go into considerable details about the feast, but I won't. So those are pretty lovely memories for me. I'm still trying to get my turkeys to turn out like my mom's. That's probably never going to happen. But I don't want or need to unsee those. I do need to re-examine some of the presuppositions they might have stood on, particularly in light of the ways in which history makes it clear that this event, as in Thanksgiving, that this event is yet another example of something that has a good moment at the beginning of the story, followed by a violent hijacking and usurping of it. Not an uncommon pattern. In Canada, it was a group of Protestant leaders that appealed to the colonial government in 1859 to create a day for giving thanks. So in terms of the holiday, the thing on the calendar, That's sort of how that got in motion. And for many of us, that little factoid might suffice as an explanation for the roots of the occasion. But the actual genesis of the event on this continent is much older, and as these things go, much darker. Some of us probably have memories of a narrative about the first Thanksgiving that comes from our southern neighbors, right? From settlers arriving on the eastern shores of the continent in 1621 and coming in contact with the indigenous peoples of the Wampanoag Nation that were already established here, and having those people save them from starving and freezing to death that first fall and winter and year. As far as we can tell, there's a bit of a pleasant blip in that history where these sort of thankful celebrations of harvest and plenty were shared between Europeans and indigenous peoples. But then the motivations running behind the settlers' endeavors, behind that whole colonization maneuver, started to assert themselves, and the desire for more land and resources came to the forefront. And this still staggers me, even though I'm astonished by less and less of our behavior as humans as the years go along. But as these stories go, as early as the year following they're being saved by, literally having their lives saved by the indigenous peoples of that coast, those same colonists were murdering and burning out the people that had saved their lives. And also decimating them with the infectious diseases they brought with them, and by letting their pigs freely graze on indigenous lands, which of course destroyed the crops that were cultivated there. But before they did that, they had an encounter with many of the traditions that we will or have shared over these past few days. The first shared celebrations in that story included many of the now traditional Thanksgiving meal foods: corn, beans, squash, wild turkey, cranberries, pumpkin. And the focus of those ceremonies, then as now, was on giving thanks. What the colonists encountered was a collection of traditions and beliefs and attitudes that had been in place for thousands of years. I find it curious, and I'm not speaking of anyone else's table when I say this, I find it curious that this rarely comes up when we sit down to dinner. Because that's where the tradition came from, right down, in many cases, to the menu. Now, Here's a general thing about cultural appropriation that might apply in this instance. When we appropriate something, we treat it as though its origins are ours, as though we not only do the thing, but we originated the thing. It's a kind of an unarticulated claim to ownership that isn't valid, and it isn't valid because it isn't true. And the path to setting that kind of a thing on a better course, as we just noted with a named date on the calendar for National Day of Truth and Reconciliation, starts with truth. It starts with truth, and it stands on truth, and it keeps circling back through it on the way to reconciliation. It's not a linear maneuver, more like grief. Perhaps it's easier to give lip service to or to create a holiday for something like truth-telling and reconciliation than it is to actually mess with our own practices in the interest of facing head-on into the hard work of change. As complicated as it is to get a new national holiday onto the calendar. Now, if that all feels a bit too particular, like a bit too kind of the cultural moment, a bit too politically correct, as we used to say, let's broaden it a bit and carry it into the space where we explore what we believe. One of the things that I find myself consistently looking for in my own explorations of what I believe are beliefs that have enduring shapes. I find more and more that the things that I continue to believe as I explore this realm, those things can often be sort of shaken out, filtered out, if you will, sifted to the point where I realize they have a shape that's been around for a long, long time. I often see that those shapes are bigger than any particular cultural expression of them. They can often be seen as pan or transcultural in their themes and values, even though the way that they get expressed in a cultural context might be very particular and might change a great deal. It might have very powerful lodgings in its cultural context as well. They often seem to be constructed of kind of the big rhythms of human experience. So, in this instance of exploring various beliefs about Thanksgiving, we might see obvious themes like harvest and gratitude, right? Kind of the connection between those things. We might also see various rituals that acknowledge that behind the plenty of harvest, there are forces, factors, mysteries, whatever we want to call them, that are beyond our human control. So weather comes to mind immediately, as does the fact that for all that we've learned about fertilizers and pesticides, in the end, it's the dirt that was already here that provides the nutrients for the food that we grow and that in turn keeps us alive. And it's kind of interesting to me that in the industrialized West, it's slowly starting to dawn on us that if we mess with that original dirt too much or too often, this can backfire. And if the dirt that was here long before we were stops working, we stop existing. It's a fairly direct correlation. So we, across cultures and times, find ways to stop and take note of this and to articulate our complicated and ultimately dependent relationship to reality, to what we do not and cannot control for life. In this case, let's just say dirt, soil. In my house growing up, the name that we gave that reality that we cannot control or change was God. In many of the indigenous traditions, since we're sort of A-B-ing those in some ways this morning, that name is often Creator, and not the Christian notion of a personified deity, to be clear, but all that lives. And I think it's worth noting that with very few and rare exceptions, the colonizers in this story regarded their story as superior. And it was on the basis of that understanding that they understood themselves to have the right, even the calling, to take what they did in the ways that they did. Murder was okay because their story was right and the other story was wrong. Their story was civilized, the other story was uncivilized. Now, let's go back even further in terms of history, and let's do it through another narrative about Thanksgiving that also has a dark twist. By the way, we're still talking about happiness, which I will get to right at the end. There is a relationship between these things and happiness, and it's a pretty strong one. Way back, so far back that we don't have a date for it. Oh my goodness. We find the Hebrew origin story of the first human gardeners and herdspeople. And the first gardeners in those mythologies are also, in their context, the first humans, those who understood themselves to be divinely appointed to care for everything that was living. And as responsible parents do, they pass that story along to their kids. And their kids, as we have the story, were good enough at farming and herding to have more than enough. And because they could see that none of this would work without the mystery of regeneration, none of this would work without the mystery of life itself, and that was beyond their full control, they had rituals for saying thanks, rituals that involved offerings of food in the context of family. Now, some observers of religion have suggested that its core purpose is to try to get God on our side, to appeal or appease to the power that's greater than we are so things go better for us. You could argue that that's a pretty cynical point of view, but it also seems to me that it would be naive to deny that it has some merit. I think it's one of the visible reasons why religions tend to devolve in the direction of more and more rules over time. If X doesn't get the desired result from whatever it is we're appealing to, then we add on Y and we try that, and we just kind of keep layering it up. This is one of the things, by the way, that Jesus as a teacher was on about. That actually keep layering up rules about trying to get God's attention and have God be good to you doesn't actually work. There's a different path for a vibrant spirituality, which of course, you know, pissed everybody off. As these particular origin stories go, the one that I'm referring to, this ancient Hebrew one, both of those prototypical human progeny bring some of what they've harvested to the Thanksgiving ritual. And God in this story, in ways that are unexplained and at first appear utterly arbitrary, seems to like the meat, but not the veggies. And don't tell your kids this story. It is not going to help them to eat their carrots and beans, okay? But as the story goes, this pisses the veggie grower off. Actually, that might be selling it short. Most English translations describe the veggie grower in this story as, quote, very angry. So when we look a bit closer at the story, we find the key to this anger. Even over all this time and distance, all this transmission, this story has retained the detail that the offering and the offerer are intertwined. It's not actually about meat versus veggies. It's about the way the humans involved interacted with their understanding of the divine. Cain, because of course this is that story, isn't angry about his produce getting slighted. He's angry because he doesn't want to attend to whatever it is about him that needs adjusting. He doesn't want to change. And if this feels like a far-fetched reading of a story that you might have been taught another way, I would just invite you to go back and read the story for yourself. It's in Genesis 4. God, who is remarkably accessible and chatty figure in these stories, like this is a fascinating thing about the way these mythologies treat the God character. I mean, God's just walking around and talking and saying these really super direct, it's very anthropomorphic. Anyway, he talks to Cain in this story in no uncertain terms, and he tells him that the problem is that he won't adjust his attitude. The problem is that he won't adjust his approach. And in the binary language of these stories, he won't, quote, do what is right. And as a result, the consequences, God tells him, are crouching at his door, ready to devour him. It's all kind of primal and immediate. It's not the items on offer that are problematic. It's the attitude of the offerer. It's their unwillingness to change when they're confronted with the problem. Now, many of us know how this story goes. Even if we didn't grow up soaking in it, Cain invites his brother Abel to go for an after-dinner walk in the field, and he murders him. And when he's confronted about that, his response is such a memorable moment that it's become vernacular for dodging our everyday responsibilities all these millennia later. His response is, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the God character clearly understands the answer to be yes. And the curse on the ground, on which the humans in this story already know they depend for life, is that it will no longer respond to his inputs, and he will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Now, in a really interesting twist in this story, as it continues to unfold, Cain, who then starts wandering the earth, is the seminal figure of culture making. In the story's record as we have it, Cain goes on to build cities, father children, and his children, as they're noted in this mythology, are the first musicians, the first iron workers, the first ranchers, and so on. He's a culture maker. Now, we could explore all of that at length if we wanted to. There's plenty to be read between the lines there, but we won't. Here's what I want to gesture toward this particular Thanksgiving weekend. What if these three stories, so this ancient Cain and Abel story, this story about colonial appropriation of the origins of getting together to have a feast at harvest in this part of the world, and this one about ignoring those origins and the shape that many of our personal celebrations take, what if those three stories are in essence about the same problem? Or could be understood that way. What if they are about the ways in which reality bites back hard when we refuse to make adjustments when we're confronted with what is true? What if they all hold up to us something that we need to see head on and acknowledge the truth about, and then choose how we will respond? What if, in the end, it turns out that all of these stories are saying to us something like, yes, you are one another's keepers, and yes, you are the stewards of the earth, and you can ignore the evidence, but it'll cry out from the ground until you attend to it. When I was writing this during the week, I wrote that last sentence, and, you know, I felt really good about it. I was like, that's a good, tight ending sentence. You know, kind of like, nice job, Tim. And then I remembered G.K. Chesterton's advice to writers, which is kill your darlings. Like, if you have a sentence you feel that way about, you should probably have a good look at that sentence and just see what's all going on for you. And I decided to take that advice because I thought I could leave it right there if I wanted to, but I don't want to. And the reason is because there is a relatively accessible choice that we can all make that can tilt us in the direction of a positive and life-enhancing response when we ruminate about these kinds of things. And that choice is to express gratitude, not only for the good things we enjoy, but to acknowledge in that same moment of expression that every good thing that we have comes to us as a gift. Sometimes the source of that gift is hard to see or understand, as can be the case for the biggies, like the way soil contains the stuff of life, the way a handful of dirt has all the same bits in it that the whole universe does. Sometimes it's kind of obvious, as is the case when it comes to the stories about the origins of many of our own Thanksgiving rituals. Kind of accessible. It's actually not that hard to sit down at the dinner table and look at the things on it and go, once you know the history, and go, huh, if I'm going to be thankful for something here, I should include in that expression of thanks the gift of these traditions as a way of marking my own gratitude, my own thankfulness. Either way, it seems to me that the better path is that having seen something true, even if it's a hard thing to acknowledge or accept, we can let it make us angry and keep us angry, or, and we kind of know how that plays out, or we can express gratitude for what we've learned and work to do what is right. And if we feel confused about which way to go, we can always ask. By which I mean that both the ancients and our living relatives can tell us that it's the path of facing the truth and offering thanksgiving that leads to life and, not coincidentally, to happiness. Told ya. that was me being smug about the sentence, not the complicated truth of these things. But I do believe they're connected. And I unapologetically offer that as a possibility.